Well, thank you, Steve, for that nice introduction. And thank you, Elise, and all the people involved here at the Poetry Center for bringing me out here from Southern California. I want to do something related to poetry, something that is informed by poetry and not exactly poetry. Basically, what's happening is that I just sold a new book to W.W. Norton, the Liveright imprint of W.W. Norton. And it's tentatively titled Afro-Pessimism. When I say tentatively titled Afro-Pessimism, because when you work with big New York trade publications, which I'm very happy to do, you have to understand that they ultimately will consult you on the title, but they will actually title the book itself. So so I'm not predicting, you know, if in December you say that's not the book you told us about, it's, well. But what's happened, so I've written one draft, and why what's interesting for me and also challenging for me about this book is that it's like a weave of my last two books. It's a book that is informed by poetry and memoir, and it's also a critical theory book, and it's attempting to do both at the same time. And so I've just got back the edits of one draft of 329 pages, and the thing that has been said to me by the editor is that the languages don't mesh well enough yet. So that's my big challenge over the next few months, to make the critical theory mesh more with the more lyrical and poetic language. Many of you are in Steve's class, right? Okay, a number of people. And so you know, and some of you are my friends here, know that my mom just passed on January 25th, and she was a really big influence for me, on me, particularly with respect to literature. And so what I'm going to do today is to read you a more lyrical and memoir swath of this new book, in which she is pretty much at the center of it. I will be happy to go into the theoretical apparatus of Afro-Pessimism or anything else at the end of it, but I think I'd like to get started on the story itself, and then you can ask me questions that will direct us based upon your points of attention as opposed to mine. So this is a section of the book which takes place in Minneapolis, Minnesota between 1967 and 1968, when I was 11 and 12, okay, years old, okay? And to give you a little bit of background, it takes place in an enclave of the city of Minneapolis called Kenwood, which until 1962 was an all-white enclave. And my parents have been pretty much isolated in that very few people have spoken to them from 1962 to about 1966 in this neighborhood. And so that's kind of the background. I'll let the story do the rest, okay? This section of the book is called Blood Redemption. In 1967, at the age of 11, I lay at night alone in the dark on the floor of our living room, listening to Gregorian chants, phonograph recordings of my mother's cantorum, the choir of which she was a member at the Basilica of St. Mary's in downtown Minneapolis. Alone in the dark, I saw myself 10 years in the future, draped in a white cassock, followed down the cold stone aisle by two altar boys. Traced with incense was the cool cathedral air. It was humid in Minnesota that summer. The summer of love on the California coast was a moist, mosquito-harassed season in the land of 10,000 lakes. but it was cool on the floor. So I would lie shirtless on the carpet and surrender my skin to the sonorous sounds, wake upon wake of mounting waves through which I tunneled and imagined myself as a priest, sanctuary. I was no Afro-pessimist at the age of 11, and my knowledge of what gave me so much anxiety was bereft of a critical race vocabulary. But I knew I was black, not because smells of filet powder and smoked sausage thickening in a gumbo roux waft from my house and no other in the neighborhood, but because we were the only ones they called Negroes. I would not be black until the following year, 1968, when I turned 12. In the dark, at 11, lying on the living room floor, I knew I was a Negro, not due to my cultural accoutrement, but because it was my source of shame, a shame not shared with the neighbors. The Gregorian chants trembled in my chest, extending the darkness in long, hollow catacombs that stretched through me and out the other side, where I saw myself occurring in the future, a future where I was revered by my parishioners instead of shunned, as I was in the first grade by a little girl who wouldn't hold my hand for fear my soot would stain her. In the sound tunnel of my future, the children and my teachers genuflected when I passed. They stood and knelt on my command. They confessed their sins to me before being worthy of the body of Christ. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I wouldn't hold his hand because his soot would rub off on me. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I called him a monkey when he climbed up the rope in gym class. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Between my teeth and my upper lip, I wedged my tongue and scratched my armpits when he climbed down the rope. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. For we have sinned. We laughed. Bless me, Father, for we have sinned. We pressed his face in the snow. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I called him friend and brought him home to my mother's curiosity. How does it feel, she asks, to be a Negro? Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I made him face the class and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. My chest, my arms, and the cabernet red carpet soaked their confessions like a field of wheat repeating the sound of rain. When my aunts and uncles came up from New Orleans or from the sweet, pungent soil 40 miles upriver, they'd ask me if I wanted the light turned on. Children down south don't brood in the dark. No, Aunt Joyce, I want the dark. You relaxing, baby? Yes, I would answer, I'm relaxing. When what I really meant was I'm composing my hymn of redemption. I was at rest, but I wasn't relaxing. Relaxation is a state of being in the present, living scenes of the present. As a boy, I seldom lived in the present. It hurt too much to be in the present. When I occurred to myself, I was myself in the future. The present was the penance, what I had to pay for my soot. I dreamed that the present would pass one day, but I arrived each year to find the present had already packed its bags on the road to meet me. It was standing in the lobby with my room key. Even as I lay on the floor of our living room and took confession from the sinners of the present in their incarnation as supplicants of tomorrow, I knew in some deep place beneath the chants that the present would always be waiting for me. At the end of that summer, sixth grade would be no different than the slow, acid drip of years gone by. Another year of seeing myself through the eyes of others. Our young Negro neighbor. The Wilderson boy. Cleaner than you might expect. Polite. Well-spoken. Fresh-smelling. Too quick to fight. Behind in spelling. Ahead in spelling. Reads above his grade level. Late with his homework. Ashy legs, gorilla lips, been known to wet the bed. That Christmas passed, my teacher recommended that I repeat fifth grade. In the fourth grade, they had said I was so smart I should skip fifth grade. My parents, however, did not like the idea of kids skipping grades. Then, in the fifth grade, I began to wet the bed more often, and my mind shut down. I couldn't or wouldn't get up in the morning. Months passed without one assignment being turned in. That summer, I listened to Gregorian chants. As I listened to Gregorian chants, I marveled at how I made it out of fifth grade. In March, I had gone to my teacher and asked for all the assignments I hadn't turned in. She said, "How about everything since October?" Over Easter break, I closed the door to my room and completed 6 months' worth of math and reading assignments in 1 week. I dumped them on her desk in April. She graded them all and gave me A's and B's. It took her a week to grade them, and she scolded me for giving her such a fright all year. I took my praise by proxy. Had I been white, my athleticism and my charm would have made me popular. My friends would have been popular too, but my friends were from the land of misfit toys. Andy couldn't distinguish between the threat of a bear and the threat of a butterfly. He hyperventilated and bit his arm when someone raised a hand to him. His father and mother were from Norway and had been tortured in Japanese internment camps when they were missionaries in China. The children on the playground got their kicks whenever Andy bit his arm. He was the youngest of 13 who were grown, all of them, and gone. His brothers had left behind novels by Graham Greene, John Le Carré, and Ian Fleming. Andy and I spent long hours reading them in his attic. In the 3 years I spent in Andy's attic from 11 to 13, I didn't understand those books as well as Andy did. Nor could I translate the smattering of French words that Graham Greene dropped on the page like spare change. But Andy could. Then there was John. John's dad was a chiropractor, which meant witch doctor in the rich white enclave of Kenwood, where parents were executives, bankers, architects, attorneys, doctors, and statesmen like Senator soon-to-be Vice President Walter Mondale, and Mark Dayton, a politician whose family owned Target and B. Dalton bookstores. Then there was Bobby Remington, who was short and stout, and if you stood close to him, you could see his tiny hare lip. Mrs. Remington was blonde and sporty and always walked ahead of Bobby. Bobby had red hair and freckles. Mr. Remington drove a red Corvette and played the market for a job. I thought it would be cool if my father bought a sports car in my color. But then, as quickly as it came into my mind, the downside followed. The downside of owning a sports car in my color was something I felt without having words for. But knowledge is often deeper than words. Bobby Remington, Andy, Johnny, and I were playing secret agent on the grounds of a dark stone mansion across the street from my house. The house had an elevator and 10 bedrooms, I was told, though in the 16 years I lived across the street from it, I was never inside. It changed hands. At one point, a wealthy family with almost as many kids as bedrooms, though they were too young to be my playmates. At another time, Senator Mark Dayton. It was his family home away from Washington, D.C., and they would live there until he became governor and moved into the governor's mansion in St. Paul. We played secret agent on the far grounds away from the main building, near a one-bedroom carriage house at the end of the wide gravel drive. The mansion served its purpose, however. It was vital as the mise-en-scene of our spy games. Sometimes it was the Soviet embassy in a dark wooded corner of Washington, D.C. Sometimes it was a SMERSH center for the training of assassins who were being prepared to kill James Bond. Our spy games were more Salvador Dali than Ian Fleming. For example, a low wire fence ran along one end of the property, separating the backyard of a smaller mansion from the Dayton home. We called this wire fence the Berlin Wall. Without making any geographical adjustments, such as relocating the mansion from Washington, D.C. to Berlin, the surrealists in us ruled over cartographic realists. If we didn't draw straws, we'd end up with four boys playing CIA agents and no communists. On one sour day, Bobby and I drew Soviet spy straws. Andy and John were the good guys. The game involved two witless Soviets running and screaming at two witless Americans who also ran and screamed as they tried to hurdle the low wire fence of the Berlin Wall and get back to Checkpoint Charlie before the Soviets caught them. Bobby and I crouched behind the carriage house at the end of the gravel drive. The Americans would come from somewhere up near the mansion, but we didn't know which side of the mansion. Normally, one of the boys who played the good guys would be the decoy, the one who would come out from a tree on the side of the mansion and run at breakneck speed toward a far end of the fence while the other boy waited until both Soviets had been drawn away. Then the other boy would try to make his escape. Bobby and I peered out from behind the carriage house waiting for the two American spies. We curled our thumbs and forefingers and held them to our eyes as binoculars. "Hey," Bobby whispered. "Yeah," I whispered back. "My mom told me to ask you, how do you feel being a Negro?"
"I don't know," I said, not as softly.
"How come?" he said.
"Pretty good, I guess."
"Here they come," said Bobby. Johnny and Andy were on the move. We caught Andy, but Johnny made it to Checkpoint Charlie in the McDermott's backyard. The next time I saw Bobby, he told me that his mother didn't like my answer. I was worried. I asked him if she was mad. "No," he told me. I asked him, was he sure?
"Sure, I'm sure," he said. "She wants you to come to lunch." I said, okay, but I'd have to ask my mom.
Midge Remington was visibly taller than her husband, Robert Sr. She didn't have red hair like Bobby or Robert Sr. Before we sat down to lunch, she brought me to the living room, and she showed me the mantle with her tennis trophies from a college back east where they didn't have any boys. She said the place had her climbing the walls. "Bobby knows how I climbed the walls," she said, mussing his hair. She led us to the kitchen. I was so uptight about being there that I was only half listening to her, which meant I only half understood what she meant. But I had been taught that when you don't know what to say to someone, rather than let uncomfortable dead air pass between you, ask them a question. So I asked her why she wanted to climb the walls. She looked at me as though I'd asked her if they ate cat food for dinner. Then she laughed and called her maid, Mrs. Zygmonsky, to serve lunch. We ate in the kitchen, Midge Remington, Bobby, and me. Mrs. Zygmonsky set a platter of sandwiches on the table and poured lemonade for Bobby and me. Mrs. Remington drank lemonade too, but with a splash of gin. As covertly as I could, I lifted one edge of the bread to have a look. I wasn't covert enough.
"Something wrong with the sandwiches, Frankie?" Mrs. Remington asked me.
"He doesn't like that name, Mom," said Bobby.
"What name do you like?" she asked.
"Frank," I said, trying not to sound cross like Bobby.
"Your mother calls you Frankie when she calls you to come inside."
This startled me, because I didn't know she knew my mother. I knew she knew of my mother. But the Remingtons had signed a petition of 500 households to keep us out of Kenwood, and most of the neighbors never spoke to my mother. I didn't say anything. She asked again, "What's wrong with the sandwich, Frank?"
"Nothing, Mrs. Remington."
"Tell me," she said. "I won't be offended if you don't like my sandwiches." The irony of this statement slipped past me at the time because they weren't her sandwiches. Mrs. Zygmonsky made them.
I wanted to see where the meat was so I could move it to the middle," I said.
This tickled Bobby's mom. "It's an Italian sandwich," she said. "Pesto, provolone, spinach, and tomatoes. You'll bloat if you eat meat in this heat."
"Yeah, that's what my mom says," I said. "She makes these sometimes."
"Does she now?" said Mrs. Remington as she nodded and lit a cigarette. "Don't torture yourself. You don't have to eat it," she said. This was a momentary reprieve from a death sentence. Until I remember it, my mother told me to be on my best behavior, so I took a generous bite. Nausea toyed with my intestines as I tried to swallow. The mayonnaise, the rubbery cheese, and the acidic tomatoes struggled down my esophagus in doughy, half-chewed wads. Then Midge Remington asked the question Bobby asked me at the Berlin Wall. In a chair directly opposite to me, she sipped her lemonade and gin and looked directly at me as she waited for me to answer. I stopped eating. I would never hire a man who salts his food before eating, one of my father's axioms. It means don't act or speak in haste, Frankie. If you don't know the answer, think. Take a moment to figure out what's being asked, my father had said. So I took in the room, her lace curtains billowing in the breeze through the kitchen windows, her polished green gas range with gold antique knobs, her Frigidaire that gleamed like Marble Comics Silver Surfer with an ice maker in the door, along with the water dispenser so that ice and water could be dispensed without having to open the appliance, something I had never seen before. Her white pleated tennis skirt, her white sneakers, her well-toned legs, and the way she waited without blinking. She stares like an East German border guard, I thought. The wrong answer, and you won't make it back. She's not just a pretty tennis lady, and those aren't pretty tennis shoes. There are razor blades in the toes of her shoes, and she will kick you in the shin if you forget what Dad said and speak in haste. Mom, Bobby said, I already told you what he said. I can't trust you to bring the right chains home, Bobby. It's pretty good, I guess. Bobby, that's how you talk. His father's an educator. I meant to say more, I apologized. Of course you did, she said. Bobby didn't give you the chance. She looked pleased. I wanted her to stay that way. Every spy knows how to keep the guards smiling. I told her it was nice to be a Negro. She blew a thin cyclone of smoke. She did not look pleased, so I told her, Negroes get to do cool stuff. Like what, she said, more alert now. I was stumped, so I told her about Madden's resort on Gull Lake near Brainerd, Minnesota. I had said our family and a bunch of other Negro families spend a week there every August, fishing, boating, swimming, and water skiing. She knew of Madden's resort, but somehow something in my story didn't gel with what she knew of it. She asked me if I was confusing Madden's resort with someplace else. She stood up and leaned on the counter with her back to the window. She lit another cigarette with the first and flicked the stub of the first cigarette out the window. Bobby said, What would Smokey the Bear say, Mom? With alarm. She looked at him and said, You'll make someone a good wife one day, Bobby. The first and only time she took her eyes off me was when she used her cigarette lighter to light her first cigarette. Now she took her eyes off me again and exhaled to the side. When she looked at me again, there was still no warmth in her face. I was lying, and she knew it. We didn't stay at Madden's Resort. We stayed at Cragen's, 2 miles away from Madden's, on the side of the lake with marshes where sandy beaches should be, a part of the lake where there were no speedboats, no Grand Lodge with nightly entertainment. No water sports like jet skiing, no elegant restaurants serving walleye pike and roast potatoes. Instead of Madden's lush air-conditioned rooms, Cragen's had self-catering cabins with screen doors in need of paint, and the echoes of their closing slapped the lake. The grounds lights were so far apart that at night you needed a flashlight to walk from one cabin to the next. It was only last year, 1966, that the four Negro families began taking the kids up to Madden's to have dinner and enjoy the activities there. We didn't stay there, however, and something told me Mrs. Remington knew it. She doused her cigarette under the tap. Robert Sr. doesn't think the Minnesota Twins will make the World Series this year, she said, as though she was talking to someone who wasn't in the room. She ran a glass of water from the tap and drank from it. Where's his home team spirit? She said.
Goops of mayonnaise, cheese, tomatoes, and raw nerves sloshed in my stomach as I bundled over the retaining wall that split Bobby's backyard from mine. As I came up the back porch stairs, I could hear a Dinah Washington song on the radio. S&H green stamps and a booklet to paste them in lay on the kitchen table next to the textbook on statistics for students of psychology. Mom was taking a break from studying and pasting stamps into the book.
"So?" she said.
"There's no meat in her sandwiches." Mom laughed and turned the radio down. "We're in Minnesota," she said, "but we're not of Minnesota. Bull Connor could save money on dogs if he had that woman's food."
"Mom?"
"Yes?"
"Nothing."
"What is it?"
How do you feel?"
"I feel like I should be on my veranda with a mint julep fanning myself instead of breaking my brain over statistics or licking S&H green stamps."
I hadn't moved.
"Why do you ask?"
She was seated, just the right height to look me in the eye.
"So I know what to say next time."
"What next time?"
"Next time Mrs. Remington asks me how it feels to be a Negro."
"No!"
Her face was a violent wish. "No, she didn't." She pressed her palms on the table as though she was about to go knock Mrs. Remington out.
"And then what?"
she must have thought, because she didn't stand. "And then what?" The next time we played Secret Agent at the mansion across the street, I drew a Soviet straw.
"Again?" I complained.
Andy was a Soviet spy with me, but Bobby and John were MI6 agents, the good guys. I caught Bobby at the Berlin Wall and locked him in a guardhouse with an imaginary wall, with imaginary walls of air. I dashed along the fence to help Andy catch John before he crossed into West Berlin. I hadn't gotten far when I heard Bobby yell, "I escaped!" His short, stout body rolled over the fence. I yelled back, "You're caught! You have to stay in the guardhouse!" He yelled, you didn't handcuff me." He was over the fence and dashing through the McDermott's backyard on his way to the Tyson's backyard. I was livid. "Don't run, fucker," I said. His red hair flounced in the wind. He turned his freckled face around and laughed. My foot nudged something solid on the ground next to the fence. It was a plastic bottle of emerald-colored Palmolive dish soap. I bent down and picked it up. Its heft in my hand was substantial because it was nearly full. I gripped the bottle by its neck. I felt my arm sling back, then it slung forward. End over end, the bottle whirled, now a tomahawk, now a wand, as it shot toward the sun. The high noon light prismed in the green liquid until the bottle disappeared in the jaws of the sun. I closed my eyes so as not to go blind. Plop! Splat! Bobby's knees buckled. He was face down in the McDermott's yard. We raced to his side. Green dish soap oozed into the grass from a crack in the plastic bottle. Blood oozed from the back of Bobby's skull. The word blood took a few moments to find me. At first, what I saw on the back of his skull was a cowlick, a red tuft of hair gone awry. Then I saw it as a small spurt of water, like the spurt of water from the fountain outside Mrs. Anderson's room that was so small your lips touched the faucet when you drank. Andy and John ran for help. I stood there, the sun beating down upon my neck, my eyes beating down upon Bobby as he bled. It would be wrong to say that I meant to hurt him, but now that he was hurt, I didn't want to help him. I knew that I should want to help him, but that was knowledge stripped of desire, and it voiced itself in the second and third persons. You should want to help him. Or the Wilderson boy should want to help him. Voices from the back stairs and a little to the left of what I really felt.
The tiny gurgle of blood from the soft spot in the back of his head died within seconds, but I stood there waiting for the tiny geyser's return. Bobby bleeds, I thought. If Bobby bleeds, his mother bleeds. Until that point, the people around me in Kenwood seemed bloodless and eternal. 3 years later, in the spring of 1970, when we lived in Berkeley, a Black Panther handed me Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth in a study session that he and others held for junior high kids at Willard Junior High. That night, after school, I read what I could of the chapter concerning violence, where Fanon wrote about the moment that the native of Algeria sees the French settler bleed, that moment when the Algerian, quote, finds out that the settler's skin is not of any more value than the native's skin. And it must be said, Fanon writes, that this shakes the world in a very necessary manner. And I would think that night, I would think of the day with Bobby. I felt a twinge between my legs when I stood above him. The same twinge of bliss I felt at night when half asleep and half awake, I wet the bed. The pleasure of release that would last until I felt the wet spot. When the paramedics parsed the story of what had happened, one said to the other, "Landed on the fontanelle." "Explains the bleeding," the partner said. On the three count, they hoisted Bobby onto the gurney. His eyes were open, but he didn't say anything. The first paramedic shook his head. "What are the chances?" The second one said, "One in a million." "Not even." When I saw Mrs. Remington pleading with the paramedics to let her ride in the ambulance, I knew my parents would beat me. But they didn't beat me. They were too dazed, their arms too limp and useless to lift something as heavy as a belt. Not only was I not spanked by my parents, but they didn't punish me. The next day, they were still shaken, but not enough to keep them from differing on how Bobby's injury should be explained to me. My father, who knew Latin and who had taught speed reading to corporate executives to earn money while he earned his PhD, talked to me like I was one of his grad students. "A space in the skull where ossification is not complete, Frankie, and the natural sutures have not yet been formed." My mother sighed. "The baby's soft spot," she said. "Talking goo goo gaga won't improve the boy's vocabulary, I, Lorraine," my dad frowned. Mom said we'd have to go over to the Remington's house together. But before we did, she wanted me to tell them again what happened. My parents sat side by side on the sofa in the living room. I stood before them. I told them everything all over again. How Bobby was captured at the Berlin Wall. How Bobby broke the rules when he left the guardhouse. How I reached down and snagged a dish soap bottle by the neck. Then I threw it. Not at him, Mom. I just threw it. My dad had quit smoking several years ago. He was trying to give up his pipe. It was unlit. With his mouth closed over it, he gnawed its stem gently. He looked at me as though I was one of the children in the psych ward he had once managed, a mixture of admiration and horror. 20 yards or more and you cracked his fontanelle? Dad almost smiled. His voice was strange, as though he was talking about someone who had broken a track and field record. I looked at my mother. "I didn't mean it, Mom." Then I sobbed. She held me. I know," she said. "You're a good boy. I know how bad you felt." But when she said this, I recalled that my first bursts of feeling had not been kin to remorse. But how could I tell her this and still be a good boy? Mom baked a casserole with extra ground beef and extra cheese. I told her, "Mrs. Remington doesn't serve heavy food." I said it 3 times, and each time she told me, "It's the thought that counts." Mom said this without looking at me. Looking back, I wonder if the thought that counts had more to do with Mrs. Remington's interrogation of me and less to do with my attack on her son. Or perhaps the two were inextricably bound. "Instead of slapping you into next week, I baked a meal you can choke on. Bon appetit." Mom and I walked around the block to the Remingtons. Bobby was still in the hospital under observation, but Mrs. Remington said he was fine. I told Mr. and Mrs. Remington how sorry I was, which was true, But there was another truth that could not be spoken, not even to my parents. What, I wondered, between regret and desire, would come of this duel in the heart? Thank you.